Welcome to the July episode of Season 3 of AZM Cast, and we are going back to basics this season. We've got a brand new crop of interns here in Tucson, and we want to welcome you all to the U of A family. We're going to hit some core neurologic emergencies to help you build a good foundation onto which you can later decide the controversies. Jared and I discuss a disease that we don't really see much anymore but should still be on your radar, bacterial meningitis. We then follow up with a visit from the world's worst ER doctor so that you can learn what not to do for status epilepticus. Jared and I discuss the merits and the pitfalls of having MRI in the emergency department, and we wrap it up with a Brian Drummond peer review. We're going back to basics this month, just Jared and I, a bass and a snare, two turntables and a microphone, so let's get to it. So welcome to everybody that's new to Tucson right now. This is not the desert. This is the monsoon desert, which means it's hot and rainy and muggy. But still can't complain because I spend all day inside in the air conditioning.
Exactly. Hey, I want to give a little shout out. Our fellow for next year, Caitlin, she's at Dartmouth. She sent me an email, said that she's listening to our podcast and she's got her residency friends listening to it. So if you're at Dartmouth out east, welcome. Thanks for listening to us, and you want to explain how, to everybody that's listening, how we try to be different than the other podcasts?
Well, we try to be different by coming out at the end of the month instead of the beginning of the month, first of all. So we are from the University of Arizona, and we're the emergency medicine department here at Banner University Medical Center in Tucson. So we are trying to put something together that's going to be case-based, it's going to be interdisciplinary, so whether you're a resident or an attending or a nurse or a paramedic, doesn't matter. You can glean something from this and hopefully add something to this as well. So we have a few segments that we put together to talk about cases, talk about controversies, give some wisdom from some people smarter than us. One of the big things I think that we try to do that stands out is we try to make our podcast evidence-based and peer-reviewed. One of the things we'll do is we'll have little signals in the form of a bell ding that will notify that there is a paper on your screen. So we'll put little screenshots of the author's name, the name of the paper, the journal of the year, and the PubMed ID, because we encourage you not to just take our word for it, that we interpreted the paper correctly, especially if it's a paper I'm talking about. You need to go back and read these on your own. You need to have a good understanding and a grasp of the literature so that you can not just quote the paper, but actually know what the paper said. So we try to keep this evidence-based. And then at the very end, we have someone who is not involved in the initial planning stages, Dr. Brian Drummond, tear us to shreds, just like the reviews that you guys don't see before all these papers come to fruition and publication. So Brian picks through, he says stuff he agrees with, he definitely says stuff he doesn't agree with, and the peer review has actually helped with a lot of what we said. It gives you a true perspective instead of, here's Jared in my opinion.
Yeah, so you know who we are. You're a dual-trained emergency physician and pediatrician.
Correct.
And I'm a dual trained emergency physician and intensivist. And Brian Drummond, the candy man himself, he is an emergency physician. He was an Army doc or a Navy doc for a while. Is that right? Navy or Air Force?
Navy.
Navy doc for a while. He's a mid-career guy. And he keeps us honest. He peer reviews what we say in addition to the content. So anyway, if you're new to the show, welcome. We hope you enjoy it.
Million ways to die.
That went south so fast.
So this one's hot off the press. I just had this one yesterday. This is a very sweet 8-year-old girl referred from an urgent care for fever, headache, and neck pain. We get these a lot. What does fever, headache, and neck pain mean to me? Well, it means that somebody was concerned about meningitis. What does it end up being? Viral syndrome, pyelonephritis, flu, a kid that didn't want to go to school. Those are the things that usually jump out in my mind. But then I actually had the resident come by and say, hey, I think this kid has meningitis. I was like, well, there's two people that think this kid has meningitis. Maybe I should see the kid. So you walk into the room, and you see a kid that's 8 years old, little girl, laying there in bed with her eyes closed, moaning. So my first thought is, all right, this seems like a girl that actually is sick. So we go over, kind of stir her a little bit. She opens her eyes. We ask her some questions. She answers them all appropriately, but she definitely just doesn't look well. So vital signs, her temperature is 38.9. Her heart rate is 144. Again, she's 8 years old. Blood pressure is 128 over 87. Respiratory rate's about 25, and she's satting 98% on room air. So, Jared, do you have any questions for this family or caregivers that you'd like to ask?
What was her prodromal symptoms?
You know, she's only been sick for 2 days, and it started with a headache.
Hmm. She get headaches ever?
No, she never really has headaches, and in fact, nobody in the family has headaches either.
Ever have a sore throat?
She's had a sore throat before, like when she was younger, but no sore throat this time around.
Ear pain?
Actually, she has ear tubes, and she's on a course of cephalexin right now for a draining otitis media from her left ear.
So what did you do next?
So what I did was I started to examine the little girl. I took a look at the pupils, asked her some questions. I said, what's your birthday? She had her birthday right off. I said, what was the last holiday? She said, 4th of July. I said, who is the greatest singer ever? And she said, Justin Bieber. So I took her immediately to scan. No, so she was appropriate.
We all know it's Taylor Swift.
Yes, exactly. So we were appropriately concerned for her, and she kind of showed that she's at least mentating well. But she didn't look great. So then I did what we were taught in medical school. We do the Koenig's and the Brudzinski sign. I hope I said that right. So I bent her knee all the way back to her chest. I said, does that hurt? She goes, no, not really. Oh, good. Another roulette meningitis. It's not really meningitis. And then I slipped my hand under her occiput, and I started to pick up her head, and her entire body came up at the waist. And she started screaming in pain. Now, I haven't seen this a whole lot. I hadn't seen that in years. But that is meningismus. What they say classically is you should be able to slip a finger under the occiput and lift the entire patient up off the bed. And that's what I was able to do. So then I quickly finished the rest of my exam, listened to heart lungs, pushed on the belly, and said, let's get this going. So I'm concerned clinically now that the patient has meningitis. We got a finger stick that was 124. We got an IV. We had her on the monitor. What's your next priorities in trying to get this patient treated?
Well, the same with any other patient that's septic, right? You need antibiotics, and then you need all your diagnostic tests on top of that. So the first priority would be antibiotics, and then imaging plus minus LP.
So when you're taking the boards, if you have this question, the correct answer is antibiotics, CT, LP.
Let me ask you this, because one thing that can get mistaken for confused for meningitis frequently is a retropharyngeal abscess. Do you scan through the neck too, just to see?
So that's a good question. I've had these before where I was worried about meningitis, and the first thing I did was tap, because if you're protecting your airway, if you've got meningitis, I need to treat that and find that now. And I've had a few people that I thought had meningitis. These were older teenagers. And lo and behold, they actually had a retropharyngeal abscess. So I went tap first because that is big and bad and I can't miss it. And then I scanned through the neck after. For her, she had no antecedent sore throat. She had no lymphadenopathy on her neck. And the other thing that she didn't have, she had nuchal rigidity with touching her chin to her chest. She wouldn't do that, but she could turn her head side to side just fine. Mm-hmm. So I was less concerned about a retropharyngeal abscess, and I was less concerned about her airway as well.
So you started antibiotics right away. Which one?
So what I started was I ordered meningitic doses of ceftriaxone and vancomycin. So for a kid, that is 100 milligrams per kilogram and of the ceftriaxone, and then 20 milligrams per kilogram of the vancomycin. And you guys can check that with Harriet Lane or whatever your drug guide is. For an adult, that's 2 grams of ceftriaxone and 1 gram of vancomycin. So we did just that. She actually capped out at adult doses of the ceftriaxone. So she got 2 grams. And I ran the ceftriaxone in first. There's a couple reasons for that. One is the ceftriaxone is not really all that rate dependent. You can rush it in a little bit faster, and that is going to get the stuff I'm really worried about, which would be strep pneumo, Haemophilus, Neisseria, the big bad things that are going to kill my patient. And then maybe if they've got some resistant pneumococcus, maybe if they've got MRSA, maybe if they've got something else, they can get the vancomycin, which has to run in slower, over an hour or two. I don't want to delay treatment for the most likely bugs with the ceftriaxone that I can get done quickly by giving the antibiotic that's going to take forever to rush in.
It's interesting. I would have probably done it a little bit differently.
Well, you would have been wrong then.
Maybe, but still, she's on a course of antibiotics already for her draining otitis. So for her, the most likely organism is going to be strep. But you have to worry about Neisseria. You have to worry about resistant pneumococcus, so on and so forth, Haemophilus. But in my mind, because of what I see in the ICU, she has already proven to be resistant to Keflex. So I probably would have gone meropenem. And in my patient population, you have to worry about Listeria and whatnot. So meropenem crosses the blood-brain barrier pretty well. It covers Listeria, and it'll catch the resistant drugs.
So for this girl, we gave her the antibiotics, we consented for the LP, and we determined whether or not we should go for CT. Now, some of the medical folklore that's been around for a long time is that you have to go antibiotics, CT, LP. With the CT, what you're looking for is signs of increased intracranial pressure, because if the patient has meningitis, increased intracranial pressure, and you let off that pressure by putting a needle in the dural space, then you're going to cause the brain to herniate. This girl had no signs of increased intracranial pressure. I actually got a fundal exam, which I'm not the greatest at seeing it, but it at least didn't look terrible. So what we elected to do, since we thought this girl is sick, is we did the spinal tap without the CT. And there is some evidence to support that if the patient is actually awake, alert, appropriate, no focal deficit, that the CT isn't going to add much. So we did our tap. We got an opening pressure, which those of you that don't do opening pressures, it's very helpful when meningitis, especially if they're pre-treated, because you may not grow anything from the CSF. They've been on antibiotics, even if they're not the right ones, even if they're not completely therapeutic. But an opening pressure can help you. We did our opening pressure and went all the way up to 28 and kept rising. And that's when I had the resident readjust the patient. I said, straighten her legs out. This is one of the things that the neurologist and the intensivist always tell us to do when we do an opening pressure. We're ideally supposed to have the patient laying on their side with their legs out. Straight. So I said, you know, this keeps climbing. This is kind of crazy. Let's straighten out her legs. And once I did that, the pressure actually dipped down and we started seeing the CSF rescind, which I've never actually seen. I had this thought of like, should I be putting stuff back into her back? No, I think we're fine. So, but it went down to 23, still elevated. We got her CSF. She had 270 whites with a neutrophil predominance of about 90% and had the same amount of reds. So meningitis on my book, I think we did right by the patient and she seems to be doing better today.
Yeah. Organism yet?
Not yet. My thought with her, and the most common one now that we've vaccinated against most of the strep pneumo and the Hib that used to cause it, is meningitis is now going to either be Neisseria, which they are just going to come in like a sick freight train, or some kind of polymicrobial infection from a sinusitis or a draining otitis. They did an MRI later to look at her brain, and her left mastoid, the one that was draining, was full of fluid. So we think she probably had a mastoiditis and just sent a couple microbes through. But no organism identified yet.
Yeah, we don't see a lot of Neisseria anymore. I saw one as a resident, and it's forever burned into my retina. She went to, I think, her PCP in the morning time with a rash, and like 4 hours later it was purpura fulminans. They are rapidly sick.
Yeah. These are patients that you see them an hour later, they're really sick, 8 hours later they're dead. The thing I take away from this study is that I have done LPs on hundreds of people that probably didn't need it, but they said the magic words, you know, fever, headache, neck pain, couldn't get them feeling better. All right, let's do the tap, and the tap's normal. Other people have ended up having a clear viral meningitis, where we got the enterovirus PCR, and all right, you have viral meningitis, you can go home, we'll just treat your symptoms. You really have to respect the exam. You have to, I wish I could have, like, taken every resident that we have into that room and said, lift her head up off the ground. I took the ones that we had that day. It was a great exam. Just imagine if you're lifting the patient up by the head and they bend at the waist to come with it, that is a kid that does not want their head moved. The other thing that I'll do for little kids is I usually have Mickey Mouse on my phone to check C-spine. That sounds silly, but if you have a kid that glues into Mickey Mouse's voice and you move that in all four directions, you can check extraocular movements and for nuchal rigidity all at the same time.
Clever. Hold on a second, I gotta answer this page. Hello, it's Dr. Mosier.
Hey, Dr. Mosier. Hey, it's Aaron Leach down here in the ER.
What do you have for me this time?
I've got a status epilepticus that we need to get admitted. It is a patient that was in our lobby, and he just, like, fell over and started seizing. We rushed him back real fast and got an IV in him and gave him, I think he's gotten, like, 3 milligrams of Ativan, and that didn't work. And then I loaded him with phenytoin, and that didn't work.
Is he a drinker?
He smells nice. I don't know that he's a drinker. He's, his shirt's kind of dirty, but I don't know. Let me see. No, he can't feel his liver. He doesn't look like he's got a big belly. I don't think it's a drinking thing, but we had to intubate him because I couldn't get him to stop seizing. And once we intubated him, then he stopped seizing.
Okay.
Well, all right, he didn't actually stop seizing. Like, he stopped, and then he started again, and then we gave him some Vecuronium, and now he's done seizing. So.
Oh, what do you have him sedated with?
Vecuronium. We've got propofol. Propofol. Yeah, that's fine. Yeah, we got him on some propofol.
Okay.
So he may be having a hypertensive urgency because his blood pressure is 210 over 135. So I'm gonna scan his head to see if he's bleeding.
Okay.
Oh wait, now it's down. The propofol dropped his blood pressure. You know how propofol will do that. Anyway, so we wanted to get him upstairs if we could.
Okay, what do you think's wrong with him?
A seizure. That'd be my first guess. He was flopping around like a fish on the beach, man.
Do you have a finger stick?
For
sugar?
Do we get a finger stick? 9? I gotta call you back.
Oh, jeez.
So to kind of continue with our core content block that we're going to follow along with, we're going to talk about management of status epilepticus, or really seizures in general.
It's VTAC of the brain.
VTAC of the brain. I like that. That's good to think about. Although we can't shock the patients across the head.
You got to do something. You got to get it to stop.
So everyone loves benzos. So I ask this question a lot. What is the first treatment for seizures? And everybody says benzos. And I go, no. First treatment for seizures is check their sugar. And this gets missed a lot by patients who are in the hospital already or patients that didn't come by EMS. EMS is awesome. They never miss a finger stick. I've really never seen EMS miss a finger stick. They always get it because they know it's something they can effectively treat and route without having the patient throw up all over their rig like Narcan. So they like treating with sugar.
What would you say about if you can't get a finger stick relatively quickly, just give them sugar?
Yeah. Yeah, no problem. Yeah, I think if you have access and you can't get blood for a finger stick, yeah, giving them a little extra sugar, probably not going to hurt. I can't see many times where that's going to hurt. So checking a finger stick is one thing you should do on all of your status patients. Go get the benzos and check a finger stick, and you can give benzos with sugar all at the same time. So in your typical status epilepticus, once you've checked your finger stick, progression usually is benzos. You start with some lorazepam. Tam. You start with some midazolam, depending on which one you want to do. And many of our patients will be coming in with already having had their seizures stopped with IM midazolam, thanks to the Rampart trial that we did out of our facility. Dan Spate and some of our other researchers here at the University of Arizona did that study. And they showed that giving an IM dose of midazolam was actually better than trying to establish an IV and give a dose of lorazepam. So that's what people have been doing out here. It's a great New England Journal article that I've been doing when patients start seizing without access. Go get some midazolam, and then we'll work on an IV.
Yeah, I try to approach things as... I think, just in the way I approach the world, I think that we overuse the term status epilepticus. And I know that Drummond is going to have a heyday with this, but I try to break things into status epilepticus, meaning someone with epilepsy who is having multiple seizures. And status, I think, you know, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think it's defined as either 3 seizures in a row without returning to baseline in between, or 30 minutes of seizing. I think that's the definition.
I think depending on where you look, you'll see anywhere from 10 minutes to 30 minutes of continuous seizure activity.
Or 3 seizures without returning to baseline. So I look at patients with epilepsy who are having multiple or refractory seizures, and then I think of refractory seizing. And when you have refractory seizing, you have to think INH overdose, an alcoholic who has no GABA left in their seizing, somebody who has a sodium of 99, or somebody with a glucose of 9.
So let's talk real quick. We'll break away from the patients, from the initial thing. Most everybody will give benzos to that seizing patient that comes in and wait for the benzos to take an effect. But what are the seizures that don't stop with benzos? So Jared just listed off several of them. One of the first ones, hypoglycemia, we already touched on. If in doubt, give some sugar. If you can't find a glucometer, give some sugar and go find one. Next would be something like INH. We don't have a whole lot of patients with tuberculosis, but the treatment for INH-induced seizures is not going to be benzos. They'll continue to seize long after they stop breathing. That's figuratively.
What is the treatment for INH?
Excellent question. So let's give you guys a couple seconds to think about it. Pyridoxine. All right. And how many of you know the dose or where to get pyridoxine? Me neither.
Gram for gram.
Gram for gram of how much INH they took?
Yeah.
How many times do you know, if you're smart enough to figure out that it's INH, you know how much INH they're on? So,
do you know why they
need
pyridoxine?
Friend. Why?
INH, I think, blocks the production of GABA, which pyridoxine is the precursor for.
Really?
Yeah. So that's why the treatment for INH overdose is pyridoxine. And also, if you have somebody with refractory seizures that isn't responding to benzos, sometimes if you give them pyridoxine, it will help. Take the alcoholic, for example, who has withdrawal seizures that aren't responsive to benzos. Well, they have liver disease, and so in order for the benzos to work on the GABA receptors, you have to have GABA. And if they're not making GABA, it's not going to work. So sometimes giving them pyridoxine will help.
See, this is proof that you can get the answer right and still have no idea why. So for those of you that are worried about upcoming tests, you just have to get the answer right. And you can figure out why by asking smarter people like Jared. So, pyridoxine for INH. The next two words to put together, the word association game we'll play, is going to be seizing pregnant woman. So a lot of people want to say magnesium, and that is correct. You do give magnesium. But the final answer, if they give you this option, is deliver the baby. That's what you do about the seizing eclamptic patient. Start by loading them with magnesium. And this is another one where the dose, what do we give, a gram, maybe 2 grams, no, 4, 6, keep giving magnesium.
Yeah, you're not going to give too much.
A couple things the obstetricians laugh at us about is how little magnesium we give and how quickly we transfuse patients. They are not afraid of 8 grams of magnesium or a hemoglobin of 4.
Yeah.
There are plenty of things that don't worry them.
I had a patient like this. I was actually working in the North Pod back when they used to let me around children. And it was...
You were running children?
I was around children. And EMS brings in this patient was complaining of a headache, sitting at her kitchen table with her mom, complains of a headache, and then starts having a seizure. First time seizure, never had a seizure before. She comes in, I pull the blanket back, and she's got a 9-month belly. Yeah, so magnesium, call OB.
All right, another one to consider that Jared also mentioned, the alcoholic. Alcoholics should respond to benzos when they're in true DTs, when they're truly having bad alcohol withdrawal. However, you're probably not giving enough. 1 milligram, 2 milligrams, 3 milligrams of Ativan is probably not going to be enough to get these patients to stop seizing. Instead, usually something like, my personal benzo of choice is diazepam. I like to give 10 and then 10 and then 20 and then 40 and then I've gotten as high as 40 with that progression, and that's the most I've ever given. But I've heard of people doing far more than that. And after that many benzos, the patient was still maintaining his own airway and breathing.
Yeah, I think we are sensitive to the effects of benzodiazepines because I was joking on rounds this morning to my team that the most common pre-treatment drug or pre-code drug is Ativan. You know, you give that person 1 milligram of Ativan for their anxiety and then you're doing CPR in a couple minutes. Mm-hmm. And I think that we have to say these chronic alcohol abuse patients, they don't have normal brain physiology, and so they're going to scoff at your 5 milligrams of Ativan or 6 milligrams of Ativan.
The same way they scoff at a blood alcohol of 580.
Right. These varsity-level drinkers, they need lots and lots of diazepam or lorazepam or whatever benzo that you want to give. There are some people who are talking about using phenobarb. I know there's some chatter about that. I haven't personally done it. I'm interested in it, but I haven't personally done it. Have you?
No, I haven't. Do you have a drinking letter you can get on a Letterman jacket?
You should be able to. Yeah, you could letter each year.
The other one that we always bring up, the electrolyte. So hyponatremia, I don't see this all that often. And in fact, even low levels of 109, I haven't seen seizures. How many of these have you seen with a true hyponatremic seizure?
It's usually if they become quickly. It's not so much that they're hyponatremic, it's how quickly they became hyponatremic. And so if you're an individual, it's a marathon runner and you're drinking water, or you are in Tucson and you think, oh, today's not as hot as normal, it's only 102, but it's super humid and I'm going to go ride my bike, and you're just drinking water, not Gatorade, and you become quickly hyponatremic. Or another one I saw was, I was just started on Geodon, and 4 days later I come in seizing. And those are the patients that you see with hyponatremia seizures.
So what do you do with these patients if you suspect it, or even if you don't suspect it and suddenly you get that lab back?
Well, you got to give them sodium until they stop seizing. And the way in which you give them sodium is debatable. So I guess you could bolus them saline, but that's not going to give them a sodium load that's going to get them to stop. The textbooks would say hypertonic saline, but if you work in a lot of places, they have that on lockdown and it requires an act of Congress, and you're not going to ask the pharmacist for approval while your patient's seizing for hypertonic saline. So one of our pharmacists and I, a couple of years ago, we went through and did the math, and if you just give an amp of bicarb, that's the same sodium load as 100 mLs of hypertonic saline, 3%, I think. Yeah. So if you're in a pinch and they've been seizing, just give them an amp of bicarb until they stop seizing.
That'll help their acidosis too.
Exactly.
But it'll help the numbers. I don't know if it'll help the patient. So now back to the patient that's actually having epileptogenic seizures. So this is a problem with their brain. They're on seizure medicine. What's your go-to for cessation of seizures once you've kind of benzoed them out and said, this isn't working?
You could do phenytoin or fosphenytoin.
So the biggest reason why we use fosphenytoin instead of phenytoin is the problem with phenytoin causing incredible tissue necrosis if it extravasates. So people are worried about this. But fosphenytoin is often on shortage. There are other algorithms coming out using things like levetiracetam and valproic acid. Usually every algorithm will end with some kind of barbiturate if you can't get them down.
There's another downside to phenytoin and fosphenytoin. I don't know if it's so much phosphatone, but definitely phenytoin. And that is, it is a QRS prolonger. So there's a direct correlation between how fast you give it and how quickly they become bradycardic and arrest.
I've had one of those where the patient was getting started to brady down. We said, what's going on? Oh, they're getting phenytoin. Oh, well, stop it. Stop it right now.
Exactly. So, like you mentioned, the kind of end-all, be-all is going to be phenobarb. I guess pentobarb would be the end-all, be-all. You try phenobarb, and if that doesn't work, then a pentobarb.
Some kind of a barb. So at what point do you decide, I'm going to take this airway, this patient's been seizing for too long? Is it, I've reached this medication threshold in my algorithm, or is it the patient's been seizing for X amount of minutes, or is it, no, they're still seizing, it's been 45 minutes, but their sats are good, they're still breathing. But at what point do you decide, we got to go in and intubate this seizure patient?
That's a good question. I look at along the lines of benzos that work on GABA receptors. Propofol works on GABA receptors, and the GABA receptor is a 5-subunit receptor, and the benzos work directly on those receptors. But propofol works indirectly on one of the subunits, and so if your benzos aren't working, propofol might. And so it's a reasonable choice. You think, I've given them a ton of lorazepam or a ton of diazepam or whatever benzo you want to give, and they're altered, and I'm just uncomfortable with this, I'm going to intubate them, and you so that you can give them propofol. I think that's perfectly appropriate. I would use propofol and or midazolam as my sedative of choice if you're going to intubate somebody.
And then once you've intubated them, now you've caused the problem of where, well, they're done seizing, but are they done seizing because they're paralyzed, or are they done seizing because I fixed it with my sedative agent that I gave?
Well, that's a good question. Do you paralyze them? Do you RSI them or not? My personal practice is not to. And I don't know if I could categorically say giving them a dose of succinylcholine is bad, because you know they might be seizing for 5 minutes while you're intubating them, but they might be seizing anyway. And adding seizures plus an aspiration on top of that isn't very good either. So I can't categorically say that giving them a dose of sucks is bad. Giving them a dose of rock is probably bad, but a dose of sucks might not be bad. But I personally just give them enough midazolam and propofol to make them amenable to tracheal tube placement, and then don't paralyze them afterwards.
I still RSI. I like to plan it. I have in my mind an algorithm that if you've gotten to the point of where we're loading with either fosphenytoin or levetiracetam, that you are status that's going to be tough to control. And this is me coming from the pediatric perspective. Yeah. If I'm done with my benzos and now I'm having to load you, I'm generally going to intubate, because kids don't have much of an oxygen reserve. So if they do start to have disorganized breathing from a from status, it's going to happen suddenly and without warning. So the kids that have maybe stopped having their clinical seizures but aren't clearing, I'll load them and then admit them to the ICU without intubating them. But the kids that are still showing active tonic-clonic seizing that doesn't break, I'm starting to get ready for take their airway. And then I'm calling neurology to try to arrange for continuous EEG monitoring.
We traditionally teach that you don't need to intubate seizures because they can protect their airway and it's going to pass or whatnot. But I'm not so sure you can protect your airway if you're in status. We see them, they're foaming at the mouth, some of them are vomiting. I have no doubt that some of them are aspirating. And the other thing is you're giving them a ton of benzos and other drug, and that's going to accumulate. And so I think if you have any level of discomfort, taking that patient's airway is perfectly appropriate. My algorithm is benzos, propofol, and if I'm going down the propofol phosphenytoin route, I'm definitely gonna intubate you and just kind of take control of the situation, because I'm gonna give you a lot of propofol and a lot of midazolam. And when you get into the phenobarb, pentobarb, there's no doubt they're gonna be in a coma, so you have to intubate them then.
Now to the controversy portion of this month's episode. We wanted to discuss some things that are not necessarily cut and dry. These are gray areas of medicine. And one of the things we wanted to discuss was use of MRI in the emergency department. If you work in our emergency department, you've got access to an MRI scanner 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, all year. But is access to it necessarily a good thing? Are we MRIing stuff we don't need to? Are we finding stuff we wouldn't have found if we didn't have an MRI machine?
If you're at a place that doesn't have access to an MRI, do you need to transfer to a place that does to get that MRI?
So Jared and I are going to take a little point counterpoint of whether or not we should or should not be doing MRIs in the emergency department. My opinion is that MRI should be very limited in the emergency department. Those of you that have worked with me may not feel that way, but for the purpose of this show, that's what I'm doing. I really do think that we shouldn't be MRIing everyone's back that comes in with an acute strain. I do not think that we should be MRIing every patient that may have a stroke. Maybe we save that patient a hospitalization. Maybe we save that patient an admission with a subsequent infection. But we do that at the cost of the entire emergency medicine machine in the entire department. All the other patients are the ones that will suffer. Having an MRI machine 24/7 in the emergency department will increase your patient's length of stay. It will increase other patients' length of stays, and it will decrease your ability to move patients effectively through the emergency department.
Do you know that to be true?
In fact, I have an article, and by talking to some of our administration, that we have been ordering a lot more MRI since we've had it made 24 hours available. So, on the other hand, there are some times where you do need to have this. What we used to do was call in the MRI tech. And when we called in the MRI tech, it had better be for a good reason. What's a good reason? I have an IV drug user who's got low back pain and a focal neurologic deficit. I've got a patient who has a focal neurologic deficit with a negative head CT. Or some of the newer exceptions that I think are very appropriate, I've got a kid with a VP shunt that I need to make sure doesn't have hydrocephalus. So I'm going to do a quick one-bang MRI in order to spare this kid the radiation of the hundreds of head CTs they're going to have every time they have a headache. Otherwise, if you have a patient you suspect might have a stroke, but you're not quite sure, I think that you should continue to hone your exam. I think we should call a neurologist and have the patient admitted. In the real world, the neurologist probably won't even come in, and they'll be seen the following day. So some of the things that are questionable TIAs, questionable strokes, but nothing that would actually warrant TPA based on their NIH score, I think we used to just admit these patients and watch them. But now, some of our practice is, well, let's just call neurology and get the MRI. Actually, just get the MRI and don't call neurology. So that's my opinion, is the MRI should be used sparingly in the emergency department.
When Drummond listens to this, he's probably going to be tearfully enjoy listening to your opinion.
I'm hopeful he'll try to be impartial.
And I'm going to just crush his spirit with my opinion, because my opinion is the opposite. Not just for the purposes of us debating for this show, but I actually have put a lot of thought into this over the last few days, and I did some searching, and I know we're talking about neuro stuff, but I think back on, you know, my wife. Some of you don't know this, but when she was pregnant last year, she had an ovarian torsion. And she came in, and the ultrasound was negative. And so I thought, oh, ultrasound's negative, you're fine, let's go home. And the attending, appropriately so, wanted to get an MRI. And I thought, well, the ultrasound's negative. There's flow on the ultrasound, it's going to be fine. But then you look this up, and the diagnostic accuracy of an ultrasound for ovarian torsion is somewhere between 50 and 80%, depending on who you read. So I looked up, I went to PubMed, and I looked up, what is the diagnostic accuracy of MRI for ovarian torsion? I couldn't find anything. So then, you know, we're talking about neuro. So what is the diagnostic accuracy of MRI for epidural abscess? I couldn't find anything. But it is definitely the highest resolution image that you can get. So you would think that it probably should be the gold standard.
I think that's probably why you couldn't find anything.
Right, it's the gold standard. It's nothing to compare it to.
Things are measured.
So take epidural abscess, for example. That is the PE of the dorsum of the body. You know, we order CT angio, CT angio, CT angio, because this patient may have a PE, and we order, Jeff Klein showed this when he was at Carolina's, that we order four times the number of PE studies and don't have an increase the incidence of the number of PEs we actually diagnose pre and post institution of the D-dimer. But we don't really bat that much of an eye about the CT angios that we order. We discuss it, but we still do it. And I think that epidural abscess is the same. If you miss that, you are going to cause a bad outcome. And we have a flood of back pain patients that come raging through the emergency department. And do you want to play Russian roulette on those patients? And we both know, we can sit here, we've talked about this before on the show, that we can sit here and talk about IV drug use, fever, diabetics, so on and so forth. But we have seen the patients with epidural abscesses, epidural hematomas, cancers that we didn't know that have popped up on patients with no risk. And so, you know, take MRI for stroke and this, that, and the other. I mean, yeah, what are we going to do about it? I don't really know, but at least, you know, if Mima comes in and she's had facial droop and it's resolved, then you can say, yeah, you've had a tiny little bit of stroke. Here's some aspirin or whatever. I think that they're going to get that as an outpatient, but only it's going to take 5 months for them to see their neurologist or 3 months to get into their PCP to get that study. And we could do that secondary prevention sooner. So, you know, our goals now are keep patients out of the hospital. And if you call neurology to admit them for an MRI, that's not going to happen. So to me, there's really only one. So I guess our second goal is secondary prevention, and I already brought that up. So to me, there's only one solution. Make it cheaper and make it faster. And so I looked up how much is an MRI? And it is entirely dependent on where you are in the country, what hospital you work for, what your insurance company is, what kind of discounts your insurance company has. So your MRI of your head could be anywhere between $250 and $10,000. And so as emergency physicians, we can't really, in a thoughtful way, say, you know, would you like this MRI to rule out your stroke or your epidural abscess? It's going to cost X dollars. But if that's the study they need, that's the study we should get. And the solution is to make it cheaper and faster and more available. And I can just hear Drummond's head exploding right now.
Somewhere he's crying himself to sleep. So MRI would be great if we could get it cheaper, faster. It tells us a lot of stuff. It tells us a lot of stuff we don't need to know. The incidentaloma in your liver that ends up leading to multiple ultrasounds, a biopsy, other things that you probably didn't need to know about. The subarachnoid cyst that now you have found on MRI that you probably didn't need to know about, but now it's going to haunt that patient for a while. The pulmonary bleb, all of these different things that are incidental and may or may not be related to why the patient actually came in.
Don't you think that somewhere 30 years ago, two dudes sat in an office discussing this very same thing over CT? This is nothing new, right? Every technology that comes on, these are the arguments that people have.
So do you think it should be made readily available for whatever we want to use it for? We should just be using MRI for everything?
No, I think that we need to be judicious about it. I think that you should use it for the things that either are going to lead to a meaningful secondary prevention, a meaningful diagnosis that is going to prevent bad outcomes, or something that's going to lead to a time-sensitive intervention. So if you do that MRI and you find a clot in their MCA, the neurointerventionist can go take it out. If you find somebody who's got an epidural abscess or an epidural hematoma, you can intervene in a time-sensitive fashion that leads to a better outcome. If you find a TIA or a stroke in somebody that's outside the window for any kind of intervention, prevention, you can do a meaningful secondary prevention in somebody that won't see neurology for a long time.
I think one of the things that we don't give enough credence to is that emergency doctors are also trying to protect their own skin. And so if I get the MRI and the MRI is negative, then I'm good. If I don't get the MRI and the MRI is positive, then I'm toast, even if the patient would have had the same outcome either way.
Let me flip that around on you, and I kind of want to hear what Drummond's going to say about this. So you decide the patient is low risk. I'm not going to MRI their back. They go from your hospital to the next hospital, and that doctor says they have a back, it hurts, I'm going to MRI them, and they have an epidural abscess. And now they have a neurologic, they have an objective neurologic finding because you delayed your diagnosis, and you get sued. And the lawyer says, Dr. Leach, you have 24/7 availability of MRI. Why didn't you MRI this person? They had back pain and this, that, and the other. Why didn't you MRI them? And there's a different response between a rational, logical response and what the lawyers are going to want.
So here's the problem: is I think that we have a difficult time in emergency medicine being the federally mandated white knights that we are, of where we see everybody regardless of their ability to pay. We just stick the bill to somebody else. So the needs of the many or the needs of the few? Are we treating one patient or are we treating an entire department? Are we treating an entire system?
Well, that's a philosophical difference.
But that's what it comes down to, is when you order a $10,000 test for every patient that has a back, the patient's either going to suffer from that $10,000, whether it's normal or abnormal, or the system's going to suffer from it.
This is getting way into the philosophical weeds, because anybody that knows me very well knows that the one thing I don't like about emergency medicine is that the department is a patient to us, and I don't like that. I want to take care of the patients, and if the patient needs an MRI, then they should get an MRI. And I think that if you, going back to where I said, but you had 24/7 availability and that's the gold standard, why didn't you get that? To me, there's two conclusions from that. Either A, don't have 24/7 availability and you just say, oh, we don't have that technology available to us. You need this study, but we can't do it. Or B, make it cheaper, faster, and more available so that it doesn't have all those negative things that you talk about, slowing your throughput down and cost and whatnot.
If we can make it cheaper, faster, and more available, that's great. But it's not. So for right now, we're still kind of at a crossroads, and I don't have a good answer for this, but these are all things to consider. In reality, do I get MRIs on people I'm not sure of? Yeah, I do. I maybe don't do it as much as other people, but I do. If something just sets me off, I go, I don't like the way that person looks, I'll get the MRI. And in other centers where the practice is just to admit, you know, do you admit a patient that you just go, I just don't like something about this patient, I'll admit them. Is that any different than ordering the MRI? Maybe, maybe not. But for the whole system's sake, I think it's just an interesting thing for you to consider as you decide how you're going to practice. Are you going to be somebody that is more risk averse or somebody that's more risk tolerant? Are you going to manage your risk or the patient's risk or the entire system's risk? That's kind of where we're at with MRI and the ED, is we can look for all kinds of things. We don't. There's not the radiation risk. So the only problem is monetary and time. That's really what it comes down to.
The thing about MRI is that we're talking about MRI for uses that really don't have a good alternative imaging option, right? We're not talking about MRI for the gallbladder, where you could get a CT or an ultrasound. Those are alternative options. There really isn't a good alternative option for the brain when you're looking for a stroke and tumor and things like that, or the spine. There just really aren't good other options. And so I think if that's the test they need and there aren't alternative options that are reasonable, then it needs to be more available.
And to kind of answer what you had said, had posed before, if you're at a place that doesn't have MRI, do you transfer a patient? That's additional cost. If you're flying them, that's additional risk. And that these are all things that you have to consider depending on where you work. CT scanners are almost ubiquitous in EDs now, but we're realizing that we do cause harm with CTs if we use them too much. So if MRIs become ubiquitous, are we going to find find something bad about MRI? Yeah, probably. But for right now, it seems like MRI is the safest, therefore the most expensive, and not necessarily the easiest to get test. So we'll kind of have to wait and see.
The stakes are higher when you're talking about transferring somebody, right? Because then you really have to say, I'm going to manage my patient's risk and not let your risk cloud your judgment, which is much easier said than done. And it's much easier for us to let it cloud our judgment when we have 24/7 availability, but you really have to be conscientious.
Happy July, everybody. This is Brian for the peer review on AZMcast. This month, Aaron and Jarrett covered some neurology core content in three different topic areas. First topic area they talked about was meningitis. They used a case of an 8-year-old with fever, headache, and vomiting who had recently had an HENT infection as well as being on oral antibiotics. So a couple points on meningitis. One, bacterial meningitis is really rare. So in the grand scheme of all possible meningitis, of all presentations that Aaron was alluding to with pylo possibly appearing like meningitis or meningitis being considered in the differential, most of those patients are going to be aseptic. Bacterial meningitis is really rare. And with vaccines, it's been even more rare. My last case of bacterial meningitis I can remember is in 2005, 10 years ago. So maybe you're going to see these cases every 2 to 20 years of your practice, depending on where you practice. But just know bacterial meningitis is rare. Do we still look for it? Yes. Do we look for it in everybody? No. Another question they were asking was, would you CT scan everybody in a meningitis workup? And I think the answer for me is no. In most patients, if I think they have headache and neck stiffness and fever and aren't feeling well, I think meningitis is possible. I don't scan those patients unless, like Aaron alluded to, I have a focal neurologic deficit. Maybe they've had some trauma to their brain. Maybe I'm worried about an intracranial abscess or mastoiditis. In the patient that they were discussing here, this patient has a higher probability of bacterial meningitis or some intracranial badness, right? They've had a recent HENT infection, which puts you at risk for both meningitis or cerebral venous thrombosis in older females, or some kind of intracranial abscess or extension of disease. So with that risk going up, I think doing a CT scan looking for one of these is reasonable to do. But most patients, and I know for boards, yes, antibiotics, CT, LP, you don't always have to CT your patients. Other people I may consider CT, or someone who's just really altered who can't give me a good history, or people with previous surgeries or VP shunt patients. The next question they asked was, would you CT scan the neck? No. I know Aaron and Jared were referring to a retropharyngeal abscess being a possibility, and they may look the same. And I don't know. I don't think a retropharyngeal abscess looks like meningitis. They may have a fever, but the headache is the main component in the meningitis, not the neck pain. Whereas in the retropharyngeal abscess, they're usually pointing their nose out. They're not wanting to move their neck at all. Their eyes are moving and they're really with it. They're uncomfortable in the neck, almost like they're in their own personal C collar and they don't want to move, but they're looking around like, what's going on with my neck? So I don't really CT, I don't know if I've ever CT'd scanned the head and neck and then performed an LP on the patient. I think it's possible that that could be, and there's always blurring cases in medicine. But I think it's really rare. Hopefully you're able to differentiate the retropharyngeal abscess from the meningitis workup. But if you can't, I guess you can CT scan the neck. But aren't we trying to get less CTs because of radiation, as we'll allude to in the MRI discussion coming up? Aaron and Jared also pointed out, if you're worried, truly worried about this patient, you should probably start them on antibiotics. If you think they may have the disease, but you're really not that worried, I don't always start those patients on antibiotics. I do the tap and then see what it shows. But if you're really worried, then start them on antibiotics. And I agree with Aaron that ceftriaxone probably would still be a reasonable one to start with in this patient. The nice part about ceftriaxone is you can give it in 5 minutes. So I would just give it whether it's going to work or not. I know it's on board and it may help me. And then I can add the vanc, which is going to take a while. So I agree with them on those points. Jared's getting, I think, a little lost with the meropenem because he does have that ICU perspective and he is seeing things through the filter of all the levels. First, who presents to the ED, first, who's screened in the ED, first, who gets admitted to the hospital, then they get screened from that and they fail that, and then they get to his ICU. So meropenem should probably not be an ED meningitis drug. There's probably some cases you could do it, but knowing that this is so rare, your chance of giving meropenem for a meningitis workup probably gets down to a couple times in a lifetime. It's pretty rare, pretty rare. And if you are considering something like meropenem, or in this case, I think it's a reasonable thing to consider, I would probably wait for my LP results. Because if I give them a dose of meropenem and the LP is negative, what I'm really doing is just putting them at risk for resistant organisms for meropenem. And that's not good for antibiotic stewardship. The next thing, if you've done the CTs and you've started the antibiotics that they were asking about, was doing the LP. And I don't think they really got into some of the specifics with the LP. So we do an LP, right? What is our definition of meningitis? For me, a definition of meningitis is greater than 5 white cells. Now, some people may say 10, or some books may say 20. For me, it's 5. You shouldn't have more than 5. I think that's a good number. Now you say, well, yeah, it's a little more conservative, Brian, but 5 is the number you're thinking about. And with those LP results, can you differentiate bacterial versus aseptic meningitis? No, not really. There's trends for what the glucose should be. There's trends for what the protein. There's trends for the Gram stain. There's trends for the culture. But there is no part of the lumbar puncture that's going to define one or the other. Now, yes, if you have a culture that grows out strep pneumo, it's probably bacterial meningitis. So just know that if you're trending one way or another, or you're saying, well, the glucose is this, so it's got to be that, in probabilities, you're maybe right, but it's not definitive. Another part of the LP they were mentioning is the opening pressure, and I have started redoing opening pressures. I didn't used to do them for, I don't know, 4 or 5 years. But in the last 4 years, I've started doing opening pressures. Now, I do it a little differently. So my kind of trick of the trade, or tip of the trade, or whatever you want to call it, is I will still sit patients up. I do the LP. I get access. I place my stylet back into the needle. I then have an assistant help me lay the patient down onto either their left shoulder or right shoulder with their back still facing me. And I'm keeping the sterile field intact and watching the needle. And then I have my assistant help extend the patient's leg. So I've now taken him from a seated position to a laying down position on their side. Now, the needle can move a little bit in or out. So it may go in or out of the back. And when you remove the stylet, I look and see if I still have CSF flow. Now, I've watched the needle to see what it does. So I will adjust the needle, either advancing it or withdrawing it, based on what direction I think it moved. Then CSF is flowing either initially or with my adjustment. I place my manometer and measure their opening pressure in a laying down position. So if you don't like laying down position in adults, and I really don't because I think it curves their spine a little bit and it makes it harder, you can start them in a seated position. Put the stylet back in once you access the space, lay them down, extend their legs, and it'll still give you an accurate opening pressure. So that's my tip for doing LPs. The other discussion point on meningitis is they were talking a lot about bacterial, and I think we should classify these as bacterial meningitis or aseptic. I know Aaron hit on viral, and if you have a positive PCR, that's one thing, but we really are defining meningitis versus aseptic, which maybe it's fungal, maybe it's viral, maybe it's just a inflammatory process, which we can't explain with the technology we have right now. And are you going to order PCRs on all of these immediately? No, I would wait until you have a white blood cells that are positive for meningitis before you start ordering the PCRs, unless you're super concerned and you think you know that this person has meningitis. I don't think it hurts. You've taken an extra tube of fluid that they can run those tests on. But if you order them up front, that's just extra tests and extra costs. And if you haven't even defined the disease, it doesn't matter what those are going to be. Aaron also mentioned whether it's appropriate to send these patients home. And I think with viral meningitis, I guess I'm a little more conservative still. Maybe if I had a positive PCR and the patient looked great, but I admit most of my aseptic meningitis because most of these patients don't feel good. And so a couple days in the hospitals, their cultures can grow out, their other tests can come back, and I want to make them feel better. If you talk to people who've had meningitis, aseptic, bacterial, whatever, they feel miserable. They are not happy people. So put them in a quiet hospital room, take care of their symptoms, and make them feel better. Second topic, seizures. I love these segments where it's just a bad ER doc talking to a consultant. You know, they're funny and it's true though. You know, you've had people turn over to you like this or other colleagues and you're just kind of shaking your head like, really? Really? So this is good. I like these. I agree with status. I think for me, status is 3 seizures or more without returning to baseline, like Jared was saying, or if it just keeps going. The seizures are just going. And I agree. I think Jared has a good differentiation into those with epilepsy and those without epilepsy. So I like that aspect. When you do have a patient with a seizure, I think for me, I watch them, and if they're at 3 minutes of seizing, I won't do anything up to that 3-minute mark. And if they're still seizing for me after 3 minutes in any seizure patient, that's when I'll start to pull out midazolam for my first trying to break them drug. And so I use midazolam first so that by the time we get to that 5-minute, I've given the nurse 2 minutes to pull out midazolam and have it ready. So some people may say, like Jared was alluding to, 30 minutes of continuous seizure activity. You should not be waiting for someone to seize for 30 minutes and say, well, it's 25 minutes and 20 seconds. I think I still have some time before I do anything. No. You want to get on top of these early. Now, most seizures are all seizures, all comers are self-limited. They will go away. So you don't have to give anything to them. But we're in the status category. And so I wait around the 5-minute mark. That's when I start giving drugs. I do like their biz buzz on seizure mimics, or excuse me, I shouldn't say seizure mimics. I should say biz buzz for other ideas of what could be causing the seizure that's easily fixable, I guess, or less easy to fix or more easy to fix. I don't know. Delete that part, Aaron. Here's some good biz buzz for other things to consider when dealing with a seizure patient. INH toxicity, treatment B6. Low sodium, AMPA sodium bicarb or 3% saline. Alcohol, think about benzos and phenobarb. We'll talk about these a little bit. Pregnancy, magnesium and delivery, low glucose. And I agree with Aaron and Jared on this. I think having an algorithm, an approach to status is all you need. My approach is phenytoin and then either valproic acid or levetiracetam and then a barb and then propofol. But I think just giving adequate dosing, especially a lot of these patients are known seizure patients and they've either run out of their medicines or have done something else to cause it, you know, just reloading them with what they were on sometimes can stop these conditions, the status episode, or their multiple seizures without returning to a baseline. And with seizures, every patient is different in terms of how they react to medicine. So one drug may work great for one patient, but not for the next. So all drugs are fine, just have an algorithm and go after it. Let's get on to the juicy stuff. This is the T-bone portion of this podcast, right? MRI and the ED, controversy, oh, we love this stuff. Aaron and Jared are right on. This is a time-money debate. And I think there's probably something else that we want to talk about in here. It's not just time and money. It's time, money, and the whole concept of testing. Now, we're going to take Jared's evidence-based approach of his ends of 1, 2, and 3, and using that in his hierarchy of evidence-based medicine, Jared's case reports, we're going to look and just talk about MRI conceptually. And then you'll find out how much I truly love MRI. I'm not anti-MRI like Aaron and Jared are portraying. I MRI myself every day. It's fun. It makes me feel better. So, testing in general, right? Couple concepts we have to understand for testing. An MRI is a test. So the first thing is all tests can be wrong. And if you haven't come to peace with all tests being wrong, then you're missing what we're doing in medicine. And you're missing how you're practicing. Remember, the best tests we have are still wrong 1 in 1,000 times. So some of our best tests, 99.9% specific and sensitive, right? Like an HIV test. So that's really good. Why? Because they didn't want to give the stigmata of HIV to patients. So they wanted it to be really good. But what are the tests that we're using? Are they 99.9%? Some of them are 95%. Some are 90. Some are 85%. Some are 80. So what's that wrong? Well, 95, maybe 1 in 20, 1 in 10. Some tests we use are even wrong. And like a coin flip, 1 in 2, right? You want to get a D-dimer? Wrong half the time. Again, these are choices. So no, all tests are wrong. Number two, why are we testing in the first place? So why do you test someone? You're testing people because you don't believe you have enough clinical knowledge or value at that point in your caring for the patient to make a decision. Maybe sometimes we do tests just because we think the consultant wants it or they won't come see the patient unless they've had their CBC for that API eval. Maybe you're doing it because you personally want to manage your risk and have your warm, fuzzy feeling that, oh yeah, the patient doesn't have that. Oh, I feel so much better. Or maybe we're doing it because we just don't know what's going on. And all those are reasons, but you just need to know, why are you doing the test? And if you don't know that all tests can be wrong, and you don't know why you're doing the test, you shouldn't be doing the test. The third thing is this test really going to change what I do? Assuming that I know that the test could be wrong, and I know why I'm ordering it, because I don't have enough clinical value of my decision-making, or however you want to phrase it, that allows me to go forward, is it going to change what I do? So if the test doesn't change your treatment plan or your disposition of the patient, it's probably not a helpful test, and you probably don't need it. More information is not always better. More information is more information. So unless you know how to interpret that information or what it means and what the ramifications of that information is, maybe you shouldn't go looking sometimes. Understand those aspects of testing. Yeah, Jared also is talking about technology. You're right, technology is changing all the time. Every time we get better technology, it costs more money. Every time we get more technology and better technology, we find and learn new things. So we're in a changing practice, right? We're not in a static, you know, we are not in a static industry. Things change all the time. So as this technology is changing, we have to be aware that we're not only finding, but we're redefining diseases, right? So Jared was talking about CT angio. Well, let's talk about CT angio for PE. We used to have PEs, and we would see them, and patients with pulmonary embolism had a mortality rate around 30%. Nowadays, we have a mortality rate around 5% maybe. Wow, we're doing really well. We have dropped the mortality rate of PEs. So why is that? Are we dropping the number of deaths? No. What we've done is we're finding more PEs than what we did in the past. So all we're doing is we're changing the denominator. We're not changing the numerator in the equation. So we're finding more PEs, but the same number of deaths every year. So is that really helpful? I don't know. Were people dying like crazy 20, 30 years ago from PE that we were missing? But now we're picking them up and we're putting them on anticoagulation for at least 6 months, maybe 12 months, or maybe lifetime, and subjecting them to future tests and costs. I don't know. So is that helping? And what do I do with a subsegmental PE? We're redefining what pulmonary embolism means. Their vitals are stable. They have no heart strain. Their troponin's undetectable. Their echo shows a normal heart. Yet they had a twinge of chest pain. And I got a little titzel subsegmental PE. What do I do with that? So more technology doesn't always make us smarter or better. So we're getting this technology that's picking up new PEs. We're getting hypersensitive troponins to pick up new MIs. We're getting hypersensitive MRIs for the brain that are going to pick up all kinds of strokes with an NIH scale of 0. But I had a little tingling in my arm and now it's gone. Oh, but look at all this damage on the MR. Oh, let's give them TPA and let's put a catheter in their groin and put a Roto-Rooter up in their head and take out a clot that may or may not be accessible. I'm sure there's no harms of that, right? So we have to think about, is the technology truly helping these patients? I don't know. That's the question. That's what you have to ask yourself. You have to be skeptical. Are these clinically relevant diseases that we're redefining and defining? Or are we just over-treating people with harmful drugs and therapy? Remember, the more you find on a test, as Aaron was alluding to, the more tests you'll be doing. So the real question is, to MRI or not MRI? For me, I don't MRI. It's pretty rare. If you see me MRI in maybe one or two orders every 2 to 3 months, that's about my rate. I practiced for 3 years without an MRI. I went then for another 2 years with having to transfer someone to get an MRI. That's a different practice pattern. After coming here to the U of A, it was crazy. All these people ordering MRIs. I felt like a fool, or maybe I'm missing something, or this is new technology. No, just, you know, it's a different practice pattern. Then one of my colleagues, Scott Lowry, comes in. He says, Brian, they're ordering a lot of MRIs. I said, I know. He's like, why? I said, I don't know. So again, it doesn't mean that one's right or wrong. It's a good test. Doesn't mean we should order it. I don't know. But for me, I think there's a few indications that I would get an MRI on. I think Jared's alluding to the right ones. Epidural compression syndromes that you're looking for. Those are reasons to get an MRI. Does that mean I look in everyone in back pain for an epidural compression syndrome? No. They gotta have something that tips you off. And I don't know, and this is another philosophical, do we miss it the first time? Missing an epidural compression for just back pain complaints with no focal deficits and no difficulty with urinary symptoms and no risk factors, that's probably the standard. To find it on all those patients, you'd have to test a whole lot more. The other patients that, you know, we see maybe or I'd consider an MR, you know, reducing radiation risks in younger patients for CT, for appies. I think ultrasound has its role here, but sometimes the ultrasound is can't find the appendix and you still think they have it. The alternative for this is an observation period, but we don't want to keep people in the hospital. So maybe the cost effectiveness is for that MRI as opposed to putting them in the hospital. Another thing, if I was looking for a cerebral venous thrombosis in a patient, I think an MR has a role in the ED in that setting. So let's talk about stroke, because Aaron or Jared was mentioning that. So for me, I do a CT scan up front. Why? I want to know if there's blood. If there's blood, that's one problem, and I'm done. If there's no blood, I can give the patient aspirin, and they can get admitted to the hospital. The MRI is totally fine and appropriate in an inpatient setting. I don't have an issue with that. I don't think it needs to be done in the ED. Well, I want to give them thrombolytics, and I want to give them these, put these coils in and take everything out. Again, are those treatments? Are those treatments that cause harm? Are those treatments that show benefit? That's later. That's upcoming episodes. Leech doesn't want to go TPA on me yet. So for these patients, no, MR upstairs. And they were asking whether you involve the neurologist in these cases. No, I think if you have a TIA and you want to get an MRI because it's Thursday evening or Friday and you know they're going to sit in the hospital all weekend and not have their TIA studies done until the Monday morning, I think that's reasonable. You're saving a hospital stay and helping the patient out. And you get their echo and you get their MRI and you kind of tidy it all up and get them home. I think that's a reasonable approach too. But having the calling the neurologist to say whether they should order the MRI or not, I wouldn't do that. There's other things that MRI is a better test for than what we do currently, though. So why aren't we doing that all the time? MRI is better for CT, or better than CT for aortic dissection. It's a much better test. Problem is, we think of aortic dissections, you know, they're unstable, they're super sick. I don't know if I can take the time to do an MRI. That's crazy. Let's just do the CT. Yet we change that logic in other conditions that they're also super sick or very sick or have the potential for illness, and we do the MRI in those patients. So I don't know. Is the MRI a better test? Probably. Does it take time? Yes. Does it cost money? Yes. So Jared threw down a little case gauntlet of, oh, you have a guy with back pain, and then you don't do anything, and then they go to the next doctor, and they get an MRI, and they have disease. What would you do then, Brian? Dun, 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 dun. Well, my defense as the first doctor would be, as an obligation as a physician, as my Hippocratic oath, I do a full history and physical on the patients, and I'm not going to subject them to unnecessary tests for conditions I don't believe they have. And then I have a conversation with them. If I haven't done a test for something I don't believe they have, I give them precautions on reasons to come back if they have those conditions. And so if they do develop those conditions, I would expect them to come back and the disease to be defined. But for me, if a test isn't indicated, it's not indicated. And so that's where your clinical exam and your gut and your gestalt or whatever you want to call it, that's where that comes in. So just listen to it. You'll know down deep when you think that they have something, your gut's pretty smart. It'll pick it up. So you're right. I would take the hit and go to trial, but you have a good conversation with your patient and you explain to them why you do things. And also to answer Jared's question about, I don't want to be defined by the healthcare system and I want to be able to do things. Totally agree, Jared. I don't want Big Brother, someone telling me what to do. I don't think many of us in medicine want someone to tell us what to do. We went into this because we have some authority and independence and ability to practice. But I will say that we have to be good stewards of healthcare. If you don't understand healthcare stewardship, you are missing the future and you're missing where we should be going. So for me, caring for that individual patient that Jared wants to care for, I have to care for everybody and care for them in an appropriate manner so I can care for that individual one when I need to. So if I take care of the whole system and save money overall and I'm a steward for everyone, I can then be a better steward for that individual. And I would challenge you guys that order a lot of MRIs, or even when you order an MRI, are you willing to put $20 of your own money down for every MRI you order? And put it, right? We're gamblers. We're probabilisticians. I'll put $20 down when I do that MRI because it's at that high enough of a level that I will happily pay some of what the patient's going to have to pay. Because cost is an issue. You're right. It may go down to $250, but it could be $10,000. And these are expensive tests. And when patients get those bills, they're not going to be happy if it was a negative test. They're happy when it's positive. Sure, you did the right thing, doctor. But a lot of these tests are negative, and the patients don't like that. So if you want to put $20 down for every MRI you order, and you're willing to contribute to the cost, order your MRIs. I have no problem with it. But think about that. Would you put $20 on every test? Because for us, medical record, I just have to click a button. I don't have to ask all the questions. I don't have to fill out the forms. I click a button. It takes me half a second to order that MRI. Half a second, click of a button. So why don't you put $20 on it? These are things you have to decide and figure out what you want to do. There's no right or wrong answer here. There's a lot of opinions, there's a lot of evidence, and there's a lot of philosophy. And you got to sort through that and figure out how you can do the best at taking care of all your patients and every individual patient. Because I know that's what you guys want to do, and I know that's what you do. So thank you, Aaron and Jared, for some good neurology talks, and we'll see you guys in August. I can't wait to know what we're going to talk about next, and hopefully you'll come back and listen for some more. All right, everyone. Have a good one. Bye.